Hi, so this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch, and why don't you introduce yourself,
Thank
Wycliffe?
you. This is Wycliffe Mbuga. I'm the weekend editor of a Kenyan newspaper, The Star, and I also am a commentator for the BBC World Service, but mostly on business and economics. Business Daily is the name of the program.
And I guess, you know, before we start, you know, my sincere condolences, you know, just seeing these horrific scenes from the Westgate Mall attack. And, you know, I maybe want to start things off by asking you, so we're recording this about a little over 2 weeks after the attack. I guess, what's the current sort of state of the conversation in Kenya right now? What are people talking about? What's been the fallout?
Well, a lot of the conversation is about the outrage that people feel, as it now turns out, even though our security forces were in many ways courageous, took risks, many lost their lives in the course of the duty, still it's now emerging that there was such a high level of disorganization in the response, such a total lack of coordination that, in fact, one of the most senior people in the government has already been I wouldn't say demoted. He still keeps his title, but his responsibilities have been given to someone else. So that shows even at the very top, they know that we Kenyans messed up. We needn't have lost so many lives. The siege need not have lasted that long, and we could have come out of it a lot better. Of course, a terrorist attack always leads to denunciations. Whose fault was this? Who should have done known better? Who should have known before? But that's the conversation we're having now, who exactly messed up and whose head should roll. And there will definitely be some people who will not have their jobs a month or two from now.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we're sort of in Kenya past that sort of initial period of mourning, and now people are starting to sort of point fingers and sort of look for accountability for what happened?
Yes, I'd say that's where we are. Initially, it was just shock. How could it happen? How do we save lives? How can we help? Should we donate money? Should we give blood? In what way can we help those who have been injured or wounded in this? But we are now at the stage where people are saying, is it true that the National Intelligence Service, which is like our, I suppose, FBI, knew of this attack, warned of this attack, and that not enough was done, or it wasn't taken seriously, or there wasn't enough coordination? Those are the difficult questions being asked. And you can see it on the news, on the evening news. It alternates between identifying the heroes. This is the man who you saw in the photo running away from the carnage, bearing a child in one arm, and his rifle in the other. This is the man you see trying to help this woman and her two children. You see such stories because now we are being told who they are, and they're giving us their versions of the heroic deeds that we saw for ourselves. But at the same time, it's who was responsible. The bigger picture is that the Kenyan people feel a higher level of competence in reacting was required after the attack, and that perhaps a greater level of competence in anticipating this attack was also required.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get to that last point because it speaks on something that we spoke about last time we talked about a year ago or over a year ago. But before, I wanted to ask you again about this question of the response to the attack, but not so much on the police and military side, but on the medical services side. This was a mass casualty event in an urban setting. Did the response on the medical side expose anything about the healthcare system, about ambulance services that people sort of didn't know about or had higher expectations for, in terms of sort of the ability to get sort of emergency care and sort of first responders?
Okay. In fact, that's one of the few successes that came out of this. You have to understand Kenya is a very unequal society. We have a small, fairly small middle class. I know it's debatable exactly how many people really are middle class in terms of their income and resources, how many are just aspirational. that they dream they could be middle class. Incidentally, can you hear a drumming noise? Is it too loud? Oh, okay.
No.
Then I'll continue.
No.
I can hear it. I thought.
Is that a middle class drum circle in the background?
No, it's a...
all four middle class Kenyans drumming together because they heard you talking about them?
No. This was a water pipe which has been troublesome in the apartment where I live for some time. And every now and then when the pressure is high, it has a drumming sound.
Uh-huh.
I thought it might interfere the recording. I'm glad it isn't. So, as I said, we have first-class hospitals. I remember being told, by regional standards, I remember being told once by someone in one of the European embassies that even when people fall sick from as far as Egypt, Sudan, Central Africa, Uganda, they are brought to Nairobi for treatment because we have a cancer center in the Aga Khan Hospital. We have very elaborate intensive care units at the Nairobi Hospital. And all these hospitals flung open their doors. Normally you have to pay or at least show that you are insured before these private hospitals will allow you. The government hospital, which is not very well equipped, actually played a marginal role. It's the private hospitals which took in everyone. Doctors dropped everything, rushed, were doing surgery after surgery trying to save lives. So in fact, that's one of the heroic aspects of this whole thing. Our medical services were found very adequate. But don't forget, many of the ordinary people who are rushed to these places, you know, the waiters, the cashiers from the shops in the mall who are injured, they normally would never get treated in these hospitals because they can't afford them. They are for people who are who have heavy medical insurance, usually provided by their employers. You go in, you show your card, and they admit you immediately. Otherwise, they'd need to see your money or they'd treat you minimally and take you to the government hospital.
Was it sort of out of pride, out of urgency? What, sort of what caused these hospitals to sort of do the right thing?
I'd like to think it was urgency. I'd also like to think that it's the way we as a nation react when we're under attack. It's not just Kenya. I think anywhere, when you suddenly realize that foreigners have come and are massacring citizens of your country, it brings out the best in you. But at the same time, no one would have wanted, after an attack like this, no one would have wanted to have a report come out that this and that very fancy, very expensive hospital turned away the injured. I can't imagine a hospital management which could live with a reputation like that. So in many ways, we could say they had no choice. And most of them have since waived all costs. They said they won't ask for a shilling from those they treated, however much it cost. So it really was a heroic thing the hospitals and the doctors did.
And so, you know, 2 weeks after the attack now, what do we know about the attackers, about the individual members of Al-Shabaab? Were they sort of Somalis living in Kenya for a long time? Was it a mixture of people? Was it people who mounted sort of a cross-border attack that had trained in Somalia? Or I guess what do we know about this sort of cell?
Okay, first let me admit my knowledge is limited, and I've learned not to speculate too wildly on who did what, because very often the first information we get proves to be wrong. But what I do know as a generalization is that every time we've had a big attack of this kind, the Paradise Hotel in, I believe, 2002, that's a hotel at the coast, Israeli-owned, just like the Westgate Mall is, the U.S. Embassy bombing 1998, it has always involved foreigners. It's never been that local cells provided anything, but the manpower at the very basic level, the sort of people who are sent in and who are most likely to get killed in the process, the masterminds, the big planners, usually within minutes of the bomb going off, they're trying to fly out of the country. That's why airports are immediately watched, and often, unfortunately, because of profiling, innocent people will be stopped and held incommunicado for any length of time because your profile fits the sort of person who would have come here to help carry this out. So their general impression is that they were mostly foreigners, but there must have been plenty of local based terrorists too, because they were speaking Kiswahili and Kiswahili is not spoken much in Somalia, and it certainly isn't spoken in Western Europe, where some of the terrorists allegedly came from. So there had to be some local presence, a substantial local presence. And
do you think that they were, that the local Kiswahili speakers might have been Somalis living in Kenya, or sort of native-born Kenyans?
Okay, this is a big attack, but there have been many small attacks. Someone, mm-hmm. you're sitting in a restaurant, usually in the more low-rent parts of town, the not-so-fancy parts of town. Someone tosses a grenade mm-hmm. and runs away or goes off on yeah. a motorcycle. And invariably,
they either
coastals, which is Swahilis or Arabs, or they have been Somalis. So the profile tends to mm-hmm. be that if there's an attack of this kind, there's a very high chance that the people involved were Somalis. And mm-hmm. those who survived the attack said they heard them speaking Somali or speaking with Somali accents, which are very distinctive. When someone who, a Somali who's lived all his life in Kenya, you couldn't tell. But one who either has mostly remained in the a Somali enclave of Eastleigh, which is a part of Nairobi, or one who came in as a refugee, it's unmistakable the way they pronounce some words. You'd know this is not someone who grew up here. And apparently there were a number of them mm-hmm. among the attackers.
So I guess maybe it sort of begs the question. So there are millions probably of Somalis living in Kenya, refugees or people who for one reason or another fled Somalia over the years to Kenya, which is obviously much wealthier. And, to what extent has this attack increased, sectarian or nationalistic tensions between sort of the Kenyan community and the Somali-Kenyan community?
Okay, let me just give you a bit of background on this. First, you have to remember, in terms of population, the bulk of Nairobi citizens are actually poor people who live in slums. Of the approximately 3 million that is estimated as a population of Nairobi, anything from 1.5 to 2 of them are people who live in informal settlements of varying degrees. Some are slums recognizable as a shantytown at a glance. Others are better, but not that much better. So these are places where there's vast unemployment or very unsteady employment. People are poor, and they need very little excuse to attack an upmarket neighborhood if they get a chance, with a view to looting and so on. So that whenever there's a political mm-hmm. riot, or even just a riot after a football match, they will stone the police, and if the police give them way, they'll smash glasses, grab things from shops and run away. Mm-hmm. So,
but it's not necessarily like a political attack.
But these are the people who, even in the past when there were these random grenade attacks, these are the people who were very, very keen to blame the Somalis and say, let's go attack them, they are the ones who are attacking us. But this was, I don't believe this was really political, it was with a view to looting, because the Somalis are not farmers, they are herders. I mean, they live in cities, they are traders. So they have shops, they have little kiosks, they have all sorts of little trade or even big trade going on. And they are vulnerable because they are physically distinctive from the rest of Kenyans. They stand out. They are always very skinny. Their hair is naturally a bit straighter than most of us and so on. So they're easy to identify and they're easy to stigmatize and to victimize because they're a minority. Of course, they don't take this line down. They're a very fierce people. They always fight back. But what I'm trying to say is, if anyone is attacking Somalis, it's the sort of people who are looking for an excuse to attack someone a bit better off than them. Because if you look mm-hmm. at the policemen who performed the most heroic rescues, some of them were Somali Kenyans. If you look at the people who mm-hmm. gave...
And my understanding is that those cases have been sort of highlighted in the media to play down and to sort of maybe temper these kind of sort of nationalistic or sectarian
tensions. Yes, indeed.
Sort of have been like deliberately sort of hyped, the sort of Somali who is rescuing children from a mall, that sort of thing.
Yes, that's true, but there's more, a little more to it. We who are in the media know very well that many of these terrorists, they may have names like Ahmed Isaac or Mohammed Haji, and names like those typical Muslim names, but many of them may have had Christian names before. There's been some imams who have been actively converting young, poor men who are from Christian families into Islam. And in fact, there are, I think, half a dozen people who are in jail now who were arrested when they were using their new jihadi name, as I said, Mohammed Ahmed or whoever. And their original identity cards had a name like, you know, Wycliffe Muga or Mark Goldberg. They were born into Christian families.
Probably not, Mark Goldberg.
But I'm just making the point that we know very well that some of these terrorists are not Somalis. They are not Arabs, Kenyan Arabs. They are not Swahilis. They are Luos. They are Kikuyus. They are Baluyas. They are Kalenjins. They are from the what we call the indigenous, the co-indigenous Kenyan tribes. So I think the media has an obligation to highlight that the Somalis are not responsible for this. Many of those terrorists are actually from the sort of tribes which traditionally are Christian and not Muslim, but they've been converted. They say they are lured to Somalia because they're given money. Once there, they're brainwashed, and then they're brought back here. So it would be a total misrepresentation to suggest that it's Somalis who are responsible. And by the same token, there have been far too many cases of Somalis who stood up to be counted and opposed this, whether Somalis who are here as refugees or indigenous Kenyan Somalis, for there to be any fairness in saying that Somalis are responsible. But in a city full of poor people, there's always someone who's looking for an excuse to attack someone else.
So I wanted to ask you about the foreign policy, the Kenyan foreign policy aspect of this attack, which goes back to something that we talked about in our first conversation over a year ago. So I guess maybe to set the context, a year ago when we spoke, the Kenyan military rather triumphantly had defeated, or apparently defeated, on the battlefield al-Shabaab in Somalia. And the reasons for their intervention were, I think, principally because of the spillover effect of the Somali civil war in Kenya, affecting the tourist industry in Kenya and in other reasons and refugee flows. But as we talked to at the time, that there, Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization, and so I think we could probably expect a reaction to that Kenyan intervention in Somalia. And are people, foreign policy intelligentsia in Somalia sort of regretting this, the Kenyan military's invasion of Somalia? Are they rethinking it? Is it sort of affected how they view their relationship with Somalia?
Well, when you're hurt this badly, when you're hit this badly, it was only human to ask, is it worth it? Did you do the right thing? And even though our president has said we are staying there, that's a sort of bravado a president engages in out of anger that his country has been attacked. At a more sober, serious level, people are now saying, wait a minute, was it discussed before we moved in? And after all, what had the Somali militias they weren't really terror. We had random terrorist attacks, true. But what really provoked it was when they started scaring off tourists, when a crippled woman was captured from her bed in Lamu and she unfortunately died while they were trying to take her on a speedboat to Somalia. This was not a terrorist attack, it was a kidnapping, similar to the acts of piracy, which are very common in the seas of Somalia for a long time. And then there was a couple, the man was shot, the woman was eventually set free after her family allegedly paid a huge ransom. And we've even had Kenyan civil servants, mid-level civil servants, who were kidnapped and eventually set free. And we've always assumed our government paid some sort of ransom for them too, because they were allowed back. They were not treated well, but they could have been killed on the first day, but they were kept alive for almost a year, if I remember correctly. So you say those were the only incidents. Was that worth the invasion? And if you know a little more about military matters, you know that it had been planned and the war games had been played and everything had been prepared long before. They were just waiting for something which they could use as a rationale, as a justification. And so when these tourists were captured, the Kenyan army moved in. And they moved so swiftly and took so much ground and then stopped dead on their tracks just before Mogadishu. And people kept saying, why aren't you taking the city? And they said, we know what we are doing. When they moved in, eventually, minimal casualties. And our chief of defense staff, General Julius Karangi, was widely regarded as a genius. We thought we'd have thousands of our soldiers die there. There's barely a dozen dead. And some of them died in accidents of friendly fire and so on. So he seemed very capable. But now the question is, we may have had the means to move all that way. And we're not the first people to do it. Ethiopia did the same thing, I think in 2006, 2005, thereabouts.
Yeah, 2006, yes.
So, was it necessary? Did it achieve any strategic benefits? Instead, we made ourselves a focus of their attacks, and they had vowed to attack us, as I remember you and I discussing when we first talked about this. And at that time, it seemed as though it was an empty threat, because it took so long before there was an attack which would draw international attention, the sort of attack which terrorists love. So it now turns out they were more patient than we realized. They had a long memory, and they were determined to strike back, and eventually they did, with a terrible loss of life, as you know.
You know, I guess the question is whether it was worth it from a Kenyan perspective is obviously a worthy conversation to have in Kenya, but I think it's probably inarguable that in Somalia, things are much, much better, thanks in large part to this Kenyan military intervention. I mean, Somalia, I guess in the year since we spoke, Somalia has established its first government in 20 years. That's sort of the very slow but a process of state building is happening, but it's happening for the first time in 20 years. And I think that's in large part because the Kenyan military was able to vanquish al-Shabaab on the battlefield. And so I guess the question is, you know, as Somalia improves, I mean, that surely has to benefit its wealthier neighbor in Kenya, right?
Actually, we've already benefited immensely if you are speaking of economic benefits. I'll give you two examples. Number one, the fact that we have 600,000 refugees who have to be fed, who have to be clothed, who have to be supported in some degree. That brings in a lot of United Nations money into the country. It also brings in plenty of jobs, and it provides us an additional consumer base, because all these guys, all these families have to eat something, they have to live somewhere. So it's like a minor stimulus. It's not something openly admitted, but Kenya doesn't...
The refugee stimulus effect. I had not heard that before.
Kenyan's government doesn't admit it or talk about it much, but it's not us, not Kenya who pays. This comes in hard currency from outside. So it's as valid a source of foreign exchange as tourism is. When you have that many refugees, the largest refugee camps in the world, hundreds of thousands of people, all dependent on the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And along with that, you have a large expatriate presence, because the United Nations always employs internationally for all its programs. And these are the sort of people who used to go to Westgate and spend a lot of money. So hosting Somalia actually has some economic benefits which are rarely admitted. That's only part of the story. Now, as far as I know, Somalis do only one of two things. The really poor ones who are still living traditional lives, they are camel herders. Move around with their large herds of camels, or in some case cattle. That's in northern Kenya, very sparsely populated part of the country. The others are business people. They import things, they export things, they set up agencies. And then more recently, we've had Somalis who live outside, you know, in Sweden and Minneapolis, in the case of the U.S. and other such. You know, they're never really totally at home outside Africa. That's the impression I have. I've seen Somalis in Minneapolis that I visited in 2006 or 2005, I can't remember. And they look exactly as they look here. They dress the same. The women cover themselves completely. Kenya, there are so many of them, you don't really notice. But in Minneapolis, it's a startling sight because they haven't adapted at all. And I think most of them fully intend to return to East Africa at some point. So they send a lot of money home. It's invested in mostly property, because that's the safest, something you can hold for a long time. You don't need to be trading with it every day, you just collect the rent. And many times people have said, especially middle-class Kenyans will say, Somalis have made the Nairobi property market too volatile, property is too expensive, and rents are too high because there's so many of them. But what they forget is, who does the construction? Who does the blue-collar work required for the construction industry? It's poor Kenyans. So, or rather, lower middle-class Kenyans. So a lot of work comes through Somali entrepreneurial activity. So it's not as though we have not benefited by having such a strong entrepreneurial community here. We have. But on the other hand, precisely because they have been so welcome, many who had ill intentions have also made their way through. And one of the key reasons why it was so easy for these people to hide here is because there's so much corruption in Kenya. If a typical immigration officer, and this is anecdotal, but it's something I've heard so many times from so many sources, I suspect it must be true, is approached by a Somali who says, look, I'm tired of being stopped by the police and harassed as a refugee. How much do you want? I want you to forge for me a Kenyan identity card. They will do it. They'll just say, give me $2,000 or $3,000, but they will do it. So there are many Somalis who are not citizens, who have no business having Kenyan identity cards, but they actually have them. And every now and then, there'll be someone arrested with 20 fake identity cards who was trying to cross the border and give them to Somalis in Somalia to come back here, come to Kenya. Doesn't mean they were coming as terrorists. They've just given up on their country for now, and they're coming to live in Kenya and to be Kenyans. So it's a pity that the hardcore terrorist minority should stigmatize a community who really are just looking for a safe place to live and do business.
So I wanted to ask you about another sort of reason that, that Kenya is in international news, which is the International Criminal Court proceedings against your president and your president's deputy. And so I guess since we last spoke, Kenya had an election, and the election actually went much more smoothly, I think, than most people expected, than I certainly expected. I was concerned about the prospect of violence, but we covered that last time. But since then, the International Criminal Court has sort of an indictment out, and actually has proceedings currently ongoing against William Ruto, the deputy prime minister, the vice president, I should say. And the president's, Kenyatta's, trial is supposed to start next month, yes. I believe. So it seems from where I'm sitting and from all the news I'm reading that, William Ruto, his deputy, the deputy president, whose trial is currently ongoing, his trial is basically falling apart right now, because witnesses are refusing to testify, probably for fear of retribution or because they're being bribed. My concern or my question to you is, I guess how is this trial being sort of consumed in the news media in Kenya? And what are you, I guess, hearing or know about sort of the reasons why this trial is seemingly falling apart? The prosecution's case is splintering right now.
Okay, I'd say two things in answer to your question. First, I'd point out that you have to understand Kenya is still a very deeply divided country. We may have briefly become united because of this tragic massacre of our people at Westgate, but leaving that aside, we are really divided. There are those who voted for one side, what we call the Jubilee Alliance, which won, and those who voted for the Coalition for Reforms and Democracy, CORD, on the other. And neither side has moved an inch from the positions staked out going into the elections. There are people in CORD who will tell you, and the leaders occasionally say it in public, well, we were rigged out, the election was stolen, we'll just have to live with that for the next 4 years because anything is better than a return to the violence we saw in 2008. So we're just taking it easy, but we do not recognize that that was a fairly won election. It's much the same way, as I understand, there extreme right politicians in the US who've never reconciled themselves to Barack Obama being president. And the same way they are Kenyans, but very ordinary Kenyans in this case, who are fully unreconciled to Uhuru Kenyatta being president and William Ruto being his deputy. So to such people, Their view is very different from the strong supporters of Uhuru and Ruto, who believe an election was held, their side organized better, won a clean election, the Supreme Court validated it, the opposition accepted it, and accepted, yes, we've lost, so why are we going back there? That's what they say. So how they see the ICC depends entirely on which side of the political spectrum they're on. Those who are on the coalitions of reform and democracy side say this was an the reason they went to such great lengths to rig the election, to make sure they won, and to compromise the Supreme Court. In other words, there are people who are so determined not to accept that result, they are even willing to say the Supreme Court, if they validated this, that they must be corrupt too. They are willing to go that far to deny that Uhuru won the election. Now, people like those argue that the whole point, the whole scheme, was to seize the organs of state, the power of state, use that to fight the ICC, bring aboard other African countries, and bring about a situation where the ICC felt such heat that they had to retreat, if only temporarily. That's one side of it. And also that you'd use the police intelligence, the security apparatus and intelligence apparatus to find out who these witnesses are and find a way to do business with them. Luckily, as far as I'm aware, they're not being threatened or killed. They're just being bribed and asked to come back to Kenya and forget about testifying. Now, precisely because these things are being discussed, you find that many Kenyan commentators have tried to look into what happened in the former Yugoslavia, what happened with the other tribunals, and apparently it's the most common thing. Witnesses drop out all the time. And I don't know if I said this when you and I last spoke, but the prospect of a life in Europe would itself make someone who didn't see anything claim to have seen something. If I'm a poor Kenyan, a poor farmer, and I'm told, if you're willing to testify, part of the security arrangement that you get to live in Europe, well, that's dreams come true. And all I want to know is, can I take my family with me? So
is that being offered, to your knowledge? Is that sort of as like a witness protection program in Europe?
The ICC is being deliberately very vague about it, but I've heard Bensouda say, if I remember correctly, Bensouda being the chief prosecutor, who is a West African, I forget exactly which country she's from at the moment.
Gambia.
She has said that, yes, many of these witnesses, given the threat to their lives, given the prominence of the people who they are testifying against, they can never come back to Kenya. Whether that means they'll be settled in Tanzania or Uganda or somewhere else, we don't know. But the assumption has been that there's a prospect of life in Western Europe. And that would distort the capacity for people to give fair evidence. I didn't doubt from the beginning that some of those witnesses must be fair.
Well, your point about the security apparatus of Kenya being sort of used and harnessed to intimidate or bribe witnesses is interesting because, you know, this is the first time in the history of the world that a sitting head of state will be tried for war crimes prosecutions. The other previous heads of state have all been deposed. Milosevic was no longer head of state. Alassane Ouattara in Cote d'Ivoire was out of office, and he's awaiting trial at ICC. Same with Charles.
No, it's not Alassane Ouattara. Forgive me. Alassane Ouattara is the one who's the.
Oh right, Laurent Gbagbo. Sorry, Laurent Gbagbo. Yeah, sorry.
You know, we can't let that mistake go unrecognized. It's his predecessor, Laurent Gbagbo, the man he beat in the election. That's the guy who has trouble.
And that's another story altogether. Sorry, Laurent Gbagbo, again, a former head of state. Charles Taylor, former head of state, Milosevic, a former head of state. This next month, when the trial is supposed to start, is going to be the first trial of a sitting head of state. And you can already see the troubles and the issues that are being raised when his deputy is on trial, with the apparatus of the state being used to influence witnesses and tamper and obstruct the process of justice. So that is sort of fraught territory and brand new territory from an international sort of criminal justice perspective.
I agree, and that's of course why it is A, so important, and B, why it was so easy for the other African presidents to fall in line, because I'm not claiming to know everything that happens in every African country.
Really? But you're African.
But it's a continent. No, no. I'm leading to something. But it's a continent with so much brutality, so much only a recent emergence from a fairly savage tribe against tribe sort of community which existed, situation which existed before colonization. Colonization was in many ways a pacification of Africa. Because the tribes used to fight each other mercilessly, and all the stories being told are never of how we used to trade that tribe. It's how we used to whip that other tribe. They couldn't mess around with us. So my point is, whether you look around Kenya, Ethiopia, the man who's there now, the president, I briefly forget his name, inexcusable, but the truth is...
You know, they had one president for like 25 years, so it's easy to...
Yes, I can't remember his name either,
but Nelson Awi's predecessor. So.
Yes, that was... So Mele Zanawi was there for ages. Was a man who took control of his country through force of arms. He was a guerrilla leader. Yes. Salva Kiir, Southern Sudan, was a guerrilla leader. Yoweri Museveni was a guerrilla leader. Paul Kagame was a guerrilla leader. It's only in Tanzania and Kenya where we have people who, you know, went to college, went to school, went into politics, got elected, and eventually ended up as president without ever once wielding a gun against anyone else. Mm-hmm. So in all these countries, there must have been atrocities in the process of gaining power. And who knows when that might come up. Some of them, of course, were before the ICC was set up, and I understand it doesn't prosecute you if your crimes were... the crimes you might be accused of happened before the ICC was set up at all.
Correct.
But all the same, this is a very... I once read an American analyst who said that Kenya is a relatively peaceful country, but in a really tough neighborhood. And that's true. This is a very tough neighborhood. A lot of the presidents in the countries around us are people who shot their way to power, maybe very justifiably, maybe fighting a dictator who had murdered people, but they did shoot their way to power. So these people don't really like the ICC. Someone like Museveni may have sent Joseph Kony, the murderous rebel, or whatever you'd call him, the religious fanatic who's somewhere in northern Uganda, who's eluded capture for years now. He asked the ICC to step in, just like it is Alassane Ouattara who asked the ICC to step in over Gbagbo. I forget how his name is pronounced. It's a very complicated name. Yes. But the point is, I think it was understood that it would not be difficult to get African leaders to side with Kenya if there was a Kenyan leader who was saying the ICC is picking on us. On the one hand, African leaders say, why is it only Africa? But on the other hand, almost all those leaders were handed over to those people being tried. It's an African country which said, this man committed atrocities. We don't have capacity to try him here. Please try him at the ICC. So it's very hypocritical. But again, of course, all politicians are hypocrites.
Well,
so
I think
it's not
from like an ICC's perspective, the reason that this trial is happening at the ICC is because of a paralysis in the judicial system in Kenya itself. Right, that commission failed to implement the reforms that Kofi Annan said they should implement, and so the ICC took up the cause. I think in ideal circumstances the trials would happen locally, but I think in this case the Kenyan system showed itself unwilling or unable to prosecute members of its own political elite.
Well, it was both unwilling and unable. It was unwilling because Parliament was given a bill was presented to our Parliament, which, if passed, would have led to the creation of a special tribunal here, as I recall, or certainly would have facilitated a special mechanism for trying anyone who had anything to do with the post-election violence of 2008. Mm-hmm. And Parliament shot it down.
Yeah.
Okay. But my point is, even if that had gone through, we now have a Supreme Court of which the judges were vetted publicly by a Judicial Services Commission. They were asked difficult questions. Their finances were looked into. Many people, prominent in the practice of law, didn't make it because they'd done something wrong some years before it came to light. And everyone was impressed by the method by which the Supreme Court judges were chosen, because in the past, the president just selected who he wanted, and the law allowed him to do this. But it has barely taken a year, and in decision after decision, in circumstance after circumstances, that credibility has eroded. Right now, the chief administrator of the entire judiciary, a lady called Mrs. Cholet, she and the Chief Justice are at war. They are using the media to fight each other. There's an inquiry about whether Mrs. Cholet allowed certain expenses which she shouldn't have. There's a question of, is the Chief Justice the one fighting her, or is he using proxies? Messy, the sort of thing we are used to in Kenyan politics, and which we thought the Supreme Court had risen way above. So even if there had been a willingness, I don't think we'd have had capacity. And may I say just one thing more here?
Please.
If there's one problem we have in Africa, and this is what is misleading our leaders, like I've always said and I've written any number of times, Uhuru Kenyatta shouldn't have run for president. He had the stature, he had the money, above all the money, one of the richest families in all of Africa. The sort of money you only find, his family have the sort of money you only find in South Africa or Nigeria otherwise. You know, Nigeria because of the oil, South Africa because of the diamonds and gold. Mm-hmm. And he'd have eventually made it if that was his ambition, to be president as his father was. But to run at this time and tell us that the ICC is a personal challenge which he will surmount because he's innocent and it won't interfere the running of state, that he miscalculated big time, and it suggests that his advisors misled him. Because the truth is, in Kenya, if you are right at the top of the political pyramid, like people like Uhuru and his deputy Ruto are, institutions serve you. You don't worry about institutions. You bend institutions to your will. And this is the legacy of the big man syndrome, which is in all of Africa, and the fact that we are a one-party state for almost 30-something years. So,
I don't know. I'm wondering if he did.
I'm
just wondering if he did miscalculate.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just wondering if he did miscalculate. You know, I think on paper, you know, he and his deputy Ruto are doing the right thing by appearing to cooperate with the court. They you know, Ruto flew on his own to The Hague to be present in his own defense. And presumably, and Kenyatta has said he'll do the same. But they're working, seemingly effectively, behind the scenes to erode the case against them. They are mounting a strong defense, and chances are, I think they'll beat the charges, and that's probably sort of the best result for them when you think about it. I mean, they're not an international pariah because they are cooperating with the court, yet they are also using behind the scenes the machinations of the state, as you say, to secure to defeatle the prosecution's case against them and strengthen their own defense.
Okay, Mark, there's one thing you're very wrong about.
Please.
They are pariahs already. Our president went to London to attend a conference on Somali where donors were offering money now that it seemed Somali was peaceful. Mm-hmm. We never saw a single photo of him and David Cameron. Cameron made sure that photograph was not taken. He went to China on an important visit, went via Russia. There was no photo of him with Putin. I don't believe there was one of him and the Prime Minister either. Now, the Chinese, of course, don't care about things like whether you have the ICC on your case or what. And he actually signed a very big deal, which economically is a major milestone, the new railway which will be built all the way to Uganda, and actually it said the real objective is to have it go all the way to the Congo DRC, where there's lots of stuff the Chinese would like to ship out to the coast. And this would not be unusual, because for many years, under Mobutu, when the country was called Zaire, they used to export coffee through the port of Mombasa. The eastern DRC Congo is actually closer to the Kenyan port than it is to their own port, which is on the west coast of Africa, which is many, many further, and on worse roads and with no railway. So what I'm saying is, even when he does a great thing, like tie up this deal for the railways and other things, the Chinese, nobody notices. The only thing is, how is it a Kenyan president goes to Russia, and the Russian president, no icon of human rights himself, won't even stand next to him? David Cameron absolutely made sure there isn't a single photo.
Well, that's interesting.
The president says he didn't go to the United Nations General Assembly. Was it last week or the week before?
Last week, yeah.
Because his vice president, his deputy, was out of the country. But it's clear, had he gone, we wouldn't have seen any photos of him shaking hands and laughing with other presidents. He's being avoided like anything. It's already a public relations disaster. It can only get worse. Uhuru Kenyatta is someone I've met. Ruto, I don't know at all. A really nice man. I don't think for a minute he ever imagined that when he was president of Kenya, this is how it would be for him. It's a nightmare. I'm sure he doesn't sleep well at all.
That's comforting. In fact, that I could.
Why would that be comforting?
Well, you know that just, you know, I am wary of the prospect that the prosecution will deliver a guilty verdict just because of the complications of the case and of the fact that witnesses aren't testifying. So if there are other non-legal measures to ensure some sort of moral justice or some other, forms of justice, you know, even if it's that sort of being shunned by international leaders, I think that's helpful.
But that's not the half of it. Just earlier this evening, before you and I started talking, I was watching the evening news. There's a Kenyan journalist, I don't know him personally, I'm glad to say, who has had an ICC warrant of arrest issued against him. Okay, they'll have to process it for a month or two, I understand. But it has been issued, and the reason it has been issued is that he was playing a role in offering inducements to witnesses against William Ruto to recant and not testify. And among those is a woman. We only know she's a woman because whenever they show her on TV, they pixelate her face and there's voice alteration and so on. A woman, and it was specified that he offered her something pretty close to $20,000, if I understood it correctly. Mm-hmm. Now, in Kenya, that's a lot of money. And these are not elites who used to drink lattes at, what's this place called again, Westgate. These are ordinary, small people out in the villages who are giving evidence and saying, this is why we believe there's an organization behind this. This is a person we saw who we know is a close associate of William Ruto's. They were miles away from the deputy president, but they saw people well known to be his associates coordinating attacks and things like this. Mm. There are people who you can't bribe. If it's like trying to bribe the people whose families were killed in the Westgate massacre. What could you possibly give them? It would make them not testify against you if they could. So there are still dozens of witnesses out there. And I understand, I forget who it was, but it could be Charles Taylor, it could be someone else, who all the witnesses kept either disappearing or refusing to testify. No, it was one of the Congolese warlords, I forget which one. But in the end, it took the testimony of just two witnesses to pin him down. So long as there's a single witness out there willing to give evidence, William Ruto can't rest easy. Mm-hmm. Uhuru Kenyatta can't rest easy. So it's far from over. And as I said, witnesses dropping out is apparently a perfectly routine thing. Kenyan lawyers who have had appeared either for the victims or appeared for one party or another at an ICC hearing have appeared on our TVs and told us, don't read anything into this. We've seen this before, even in the Arusha Tribunal for Rwanda, which was right next door. Many Kenyan lawyers were involved. They said witnesses kept dropping out all the time, didn't prevent the cases going forward, didn't prevent the matter dragging on for years. And of course, if you're president or deputy president, if this drags on for 2 years, what are your chances of re-election? And don't forget, it's a strange fact but true, that most of the people who were killed were from President Uhuru Kenyatta's tribe, and it's generally believed that those who killed them were from Deputy President Ruto's tribe. Mm-hmm. That's why it's a very strange political alliance. Mm-hmm. So as you hear this evidence day after day, it strains the alliance. It reminds people of what happened. So it's not a comfortable situation at all. Forget the moral aspects of it, even in terms of potential consequences, political, personal, legal, it's a nightmare. That's why I think it would have been far better if they were really that sure they were innocent. Just face the trial, you know, spend whatever you need to. They're both very rich men. Get the best lawyers, fight and win, and then come back and say, all right, now that that's taken care of, I'd like to be the next president of Kenya.
Interesting. Well, I'm so glad I'm speaking to you precisely because that's a perspective that I reading the international press, I don't see. So that's really helpful and interesting. This is great. Wycliffe, thank you so much.
Mark, thank
this
you.
This was a great conversation, and let's speak again. Maybe we don't have to wait a year, but I learned so much from speaking to you, so thanks so much.